G'day. That's right. It's time for Cinema Yugen! G'day, Yugenites. Welcome back. I'm your host, Cantil. You're listening to Cinema Yugen on Spotify or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. My guest today, Jamie Greffey, is a screenwriter, hybrid essayist, and author who weaves scripts of twisted suspense, horror, and dynamic action. Actively collaborating across genres, Greffey is inept at crafting works that mesmerize and entrance audiences worldwide. His literary work, including novelizations, fiction, and creative nonfiction, is in print through Heidegger Publishing, Eraserhead Press, Bizarro Pulp Press, and Rooster Republic Press, among other indie publishers. He holds an MFA in creative writing from the New England College, where he focused on horror and the sublime. Though he has lived and worked extensively in Japan, China, and South Korea, Greffey now resides in Los Angeles, and he is our guest today on Cinema Yugen. Jamie, welcome to the program.
I mean, one of the main reasons I've always wanted to do an interview with you and have a chat with you is we kind of came up not only by the same roads, but by the same means. We both kind of kicked off in that weird little pool that was the Bizarro Fiction crowd, and both found our way into writing movies. Now, I've heard on other interviews you've done, I mean, that was some of that was by pure chance for you, wasn't it, coming into that the way you came into it?
Yeah, that was a long time ago. It was, but it was really serendipitous because I was writing a lot. I was really trying to figure out some voice at that time. And I think something really cracked open when I started exploring this kind of cinematic style. And in particular, I just thought, and we're going back like 10 years. And I think when you're just kind of starting writing, you put everything out, you try everything, at least I did, different formats, different voices, different styles. And finally, I was like, you know what? I was like, I'm really avoiding something in my own writing. And just the idea that I was avoiding something opened up this truth to no longer avoid it. And that was the day that I just said, you know what? I grew up watching a lot of really weird, fun movies that meant a lot to me, and reading books that were anything from like Stephen King to Dungeons and Dragons books to, you know, whatever I could get my hands on. So I was like, you know, I'm going to stop trying to be serious, and I'm going to just really dip into something that's really natural to me. And I ended up writing, you know, this short story that was, I guess in retrospect, it's really kind of kinky and fetishy, but it's about like these kind of, you know, beautiful vixens that invade this home and just destroy this man's life. And he's just kind of caught in this moment. And that was actually a short piece. And I just like, I felt so turned on by it in a really pure, wholesome way. So I thought, wow, that's really cool. Like fiction can kind of do that. I can do that. And I can kind of speak these truths that things that I want to talk about. And so I kind of stretched that out and I conjured up some Jim Wynorski energy. And I thought, you know, I'm going to go way back into like how some of these people did it, you know, how they kind of spoke their truths. And I don't care if it's immature or stupid or whatever, I'm going to expand this into something real. And actually that was, then picked up by Eraserhead Press, really, really out of the blue. I just didn't think they were going to take it, but I guess when you start getting rejected like 50 times for one manuscript, you just start to think nobody's going to take it. Yeah. And so that they took it and then helped clean it up as in the way they did was very appreciated. And some months after that, I actually was working with Jim Wynorski himself. So it kind of turned around into I sent him a copy of the book. And I said, like, I think there's some of you in this text, and let me write a novel, you know, of Chopping Mall. And that was kind of being talked about, but he pivoted it into screenwriting, and then I kind of just took it from there.
Right. Yeah. No, it's weird how much we cross over as far as our journeys are.
Yeah.
Is concerned, because it was similar. I was on the screenplay, but the screenplay wasn't to me. You know, I was going through quite a. It's a whole other episode, but I got really close in my 20s, and so close that I thought, oh, everyone said this is hard. What a load of bullshit! I've done it first time out the game. But I mean it's a long, complicated story. But it basically involved I got paid the most amount for a script I'd ever been paid at that time, which was like $7,000. And it was going to be a big action movie, and it was going to be, from this producer's point of view, it was going to be directed by Philip Noyce, and it's going to be just incredible. By Monday, this all happened on a Friday, got paid, all great, did a recce on the weekend on the USS Kitty Hawk. It was all happening. By Monday, it was all over. The bloke who initially hired me called me and he said, this producer's getting to jail for fraud, because he was basically just all the money he was going around raising under the pretense they're going to make this movie was all crap, you know.
I mean,
that was really early
on. I believe it.
So after that, it was kind of a depressing, slow decline, and then I was crying in a beer, not literally, with a mate, and he said, you know, look, you're so dedicated to writing movies and you've got all these good stories. Why don't you try to turn some of them into books and maybe you'll get in that way? And, you know, it's like that old saying, you know, sometimes you can hear something from a friend or a mate that you can't hear from your nearest and dearest. Like if your mother told you, you're like, oh, yeah, good on your mum. Yeah, write books. Yeah. Yes, but when a mate tells you that, you know, why does it have to be a screenplay? Why can't it be a book, right?
Yeah.
And absolutely. So, and thus, you know, that began like a 3-year odyssey, because I went through all the proper channels, you know, the way they tell you, you know, get a literary agent and submit to all the publishers. And I did Australia, I did the UK, and I did finally the US. And the very last on the list was this little place called the Strange House Books. And I basically sent a letter along with a couple of submissions. And I said, look, they shoot horses, don't they? If I can't impress you guys, you might as well take me around the back, take me to the knackers, because I'm done. I've been all over the continents and I've got more rejection letters than, you know, Stephen King and all the other big dudes combined. I mean, if it doesn't impress you, there's no hope. Yeah. And that odd little book with an alien with 13 penises in it kickstarted, you know, a fire and led from, you know, one thing to another, and here we are. And you know, the tale of two westerns, I call it, because it started with a western, and the screenwriting began with a western with Michael Paré, of all people, Eddie in the
Crown. Wow. Fantastic. Well, I'm glad you were able to express your love of 13 penises on the page.
Well, it was supposed to be bizarre. I remember I got rejected from one publisher that has since been taken over, oddly enough, by one of the blokes who was in Strange House in the beginning, Don Noble. It was a Bizarro Pulp Press. I don't know if you remember them. But
I did something through that publishing house too.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
When I early on, I forget the name of the bloke who was the honcho there at the time. It wasn't the guy that eventually took it over. But he said, you know, your stuff is good, but it's just not bizarro enough. So I sat down that night with my friend Jack Daniels, and we recomposed the story and added.
There you go.
The most bizarre stuff that Jack had come up with. And Jack obviously did his job, because we had a publishing contract not long after that. So thank you, Jack Daniel.
Oh, right. Good for you.
But
that's great.
It's it's a pretty tough trip when you don't know how to go, because you've been told the ways that you're meant to go in this crazy thing that's called writing for a living. But none of those really work. They do in theory, but not in practice, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm always trying to figure out like what works and what has worked. And more often than not throughout the years, I mean, a lot of things just kind of don't end up working. But at the same time, I look back and I go, well, like, a lot of projects actually did happen. And I think through all the kind of twisting path of my life, I've been able to kind of successfully wrangle out project after project. I don't think they make anybody any money, but you know, somebody out there kind of keeps believing in me. So as long as, and I shouldn't say that, I think some of the projects were actually quite successful, but, but they come out and they go out into the world and they kind of disappear after that. And, you know, another one kind of comes out after that. And I'm just always humbled when that happens. And, there's been a lot of bigger projects that have kind of tried to make their way to the top or make their way to reality, but that's yet to be cracked open. Not to say that some aren't in progress right now. There's always kind of a few that are, you know, struggling to kind of wait their turn and come out when they will. But, you know, but I'm always like every kind of project I write, I always kind of write it. And then I just go, you know, I'm not compelled to write every day. And, you know, I don't do that. I'll write by projects when they come to me, or if somebody says, hey, I got something I really want you to work on and here's what it is. And, you know, this is what I need. Are you interested? And maybe we go out and we talk about it and we have something in common in that moment and we maybe see an opportunity to bring it to life. I think that that's more where I'm at now. And then I'll go, yeah, you know, I'll be able to do this. But as far as writing fiction, you know, oddly enough, like after I got my master's degree in writing, I don't want to put that, it's not like a cause and effect thing or I got my master's degree and then I kind of stopped writing. Actually, that's not true at all. It's just after I got my master's degree, I really kind of came to that point of honesty where I was like, well, maybe fiction writing isn't for me. Not that I don't enjoy the process, absolutely, but fiction writing I'm, you know, around that time we moved out to Los Angeles. And so I was like, well, if I'm going to live in Los Angeles, I really want to write screenplays and, you know, develop that skill and develop the artistry of the screenplay. And I think that's kind of been where I'm at. So like right now, like I'm working on a new project that just kind of came to life. I had a meeting last week. Wrote a treatment. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And this came about in a really serendipitous way from somebody that used to be really obsessed with me. And he would send me contacts.
He wasn't stalking.
I love the
front of your house in a tent or something.
No, I was definitely a stalker, but he was like a producer. He like was stalking me, but like he wanted every script I ever wrote. He was sending them out to people. He was sending me ideas, and he's a wonderful, 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 sweet person who I've never met in person, but he's helped me actually an incredible amount. And he put me out there to people constantly. And so this kind of ended up coming back around to somebody who, you know, was looking for a writer. And so, like I said, we had a meeting last week, cranked out the treatment, and I was actually going to start working on the script today because I have some time today, but I took a little nap instead. And then I contacted you. So I think I might write some page because you've been, you know, you've been so kind and patient with me. So I'm going to give Kent a chance.
You're very kind. You're a bit of a kindred spirit. I'm very similar. I find it very refreshing to talk to another writer who doesn't. I know there are a lot that say, you know, discipline is doing it every day. I don't, never have. I don't sit down and I don't have writer's hours or anything like that sort of thing. I'm very much a pump and dump sort of guy. Like they ring me up or they send me a message with synopsis, and this is what it is. This is how long it needs to be. This is how many characters there are. Go to, you know, or sometimes they might say, watch a couple of these movies. We want to do that, but cheaper. So that's kind of the way it goes. I admit one or two screenplays that are like the big rock in Pale Rider that I chip away at. They're my, like, you know, if someone ever asks, if I ever get high enough up the cherry tree and someone asks that immortal question, what else do you have? I've got some good stuff.
You got some bangers. Good.
Just in case. It's like going to a party and, you know, there's going to be beer there, but you figure that it might require something that's, I don't know, add a little bit more spark, a little bit more spice, that 11th secret herb and spice to things. So you have something ready. I mean, it was like I did an interview once with Damien Lichtenstein, who did 3,000 Miles to Graceland. And he told a great story of when he came out to Los Angeles, being predominantly from New York. He had the script, and through his wife had this friend, and she said, you know, she'd come around for dinner. My boyfriend is in the film business. Maybe he could, you know, give you some advice, help you out and stuff now that you're coming over here. And so they go into the house. And she says, oh, just wait here in the living room. He'll be through in a second. And Damien said, I looked over at the mantelpiece and there was 2 Academy Awards. So I thought, oh, okay, he's in the film business. And he said, next minute, just like a scene in a movie, Kevin Costner walks into the living room. And he's like, hey, guys, I'm Kevin. And they're like, hi, Kevin, are those yours? Yeah. They're my trophies.
And
what was great is they became, he said, I wanted to give him the script that night because he always had a copy in his car. But he said, I thought, no, don't do that. That's what they all do out here. And so he started becoming a good friend and hanging out with Kevin Costner. And then one day they were sitting at the house talking and he says the immortal lines, you know, we should, I like some of the stuff you've done. We should do something together. He goes, do you have anything that you're working on? Wait a minute. And he ran out to his car and got the script and, you know, the rest is history.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
It always helps to have a fit handy.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, I can only dream of those kind of encounters. And I think if I did have a script handy, I mean, it's probably, you know, in that case, I'm sure that script was also very kind of commercially textured in just the right way. And I'm just like, that's really great.
I mean, I think completely different era we're talking about as far as.
I've had scripts. Yeah. I've been in situations where I'll ask people that I really like, you know, what are you looking for? And then they'll tell me what they're looking for. And then sometimes I'll have something that kind of fits that and it'll get to them and they'll read it. But what usually happens 9 times out of 10 is they'll read something and go, well, this is really, you know, the texture, the tone, it's really nice. It's really well written. But like, you know, ultimately I have this other thing that I really want to work on. Would you like to kind of be a part of this? Those are challenging situations. They're the ones that kind of come up more than anything. Maybe that's why I don't write every day anymore, is because I feel like I've already, like I can already kind of conjure up the writing. I can put it on the page. I can write things pretty well, I think, and clean them up, you know, even better. But I feel like the real magic is kind of translating when the other person comes and says, this is what I want. You know, can you make it come to life on the page? Yeah. That's where there's a different magic there that needs to be conjured up. There's a different kind of strength. There's a different kind of the ability to tap into somebody else's dreams and somebody else's idea and then duplicate that and then give it back to them in the way they want it is kind of what happens to me more than anything else. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just the thing. It's just kind of how it is with screenwriting at this point.
Yeah.
What kind of lead
in? No, it's again, yes, very similar. I my experience is very much the same. I mean, I have presented original work to directors that have given me a shot to write for them, and they'll look at it and then they sort of they go, well, it's very well written, but then it shifts directly to all, you know, it's very well written, but I have something that I want to do, and then you get, you know, can you do that for me, sort of. You know,
so. But it makes sense, though. It makes sense because, like, if the director is connected to the producer and they're connected to the money and they're connected to the studio who can actually get it made, then, you know, for sure, that's kind of the project they're going to try to get you to help bring to life. So it really becomes, you know, a project that's it's not really indulgent at that point. Where I think when I started writing fiction a long time ago, or when I wrote books, they were very indulgent, and spec screenplays, like all the spec screenplays I wrote, were completely just like, you know, whatever I wanted to write and put on the page. Now, recently, I did write a script that was, what's that?
No thought of budget or
not really. Well, that's not completely true. At first, I did write some that were very indulgent, and they had kind of multiple locations or some effects and whatnot. But then, actually, quite early on, I had the good fortune to speak with producer out here who does a lot of work, but anyway, he started thinking like, hey, you know, really focus on location when you write these scripts, really focus on, even when you're doing a spec script, really kind of pull it down, try to make it so that when somebody reads it, you know, you're really thinking like a producer. Actually, that helped me a lot when I worked a lot with Gregory Hatanaka, and I've done, you know, I've sold him so many scripts, I can't even keep track of how many he bought a lot, and which was amazing. And he gave me so many opportunities. Actually, a lot of them got made, you know, nobody watches them, which is fine, but they get made, they come out, and just to kind of see how he translates those scripts, you know, from script to screen, you know, was always such a good lesson in small indie cinema.
Yeah.
And, you know, how to make it work, how to deal with setbacks, how to deal with limitations, how to deal with scenes that might not work when you thought they would work. And now you have to kind of suddenly deal with something on the fly that you didn't want to deal with. And he's also a master of kind of improvisation. So, you know, he kind of flows in his own way as well. And he might take a script and, you know, like he took a script of mine, that a movie that just came out called Panic, and it's on YouTube right now. And it's about a woman who kind of suffers these very violent convulsions that started happening to her after she took this trip out to the desert. And she kind of thinks she might have had some encounter with some extraterrestrial force. It's kind of it's uncertain, but something's really haunting her now and causing her to kind of go into these convulsions. And it's kind of sexual, kind of not. It's kind of psychosexual in a way. And so he took that script and he said, hey, you know, this is really good. You know, this is what I wanted, but like, could you change X, Y, and Z? And I changed X, Y, and Z. And then when he went into the studio to shoot it, I didn't realize this, but he actually shot, you know, both drafts of the script. And he made one like a gay couple, two guys, and in their life, you know, just literally having the, you know, doing the script. And then he kind of just shot at the same time he shot the other one with a female lead, just kind of for a more hetero audience. So there's like two different versions of the same exact script. One's called Convulsion and the other is called Panic. And that's just kind of him on the fly, just going like, well, I got the locations, you know, I have the people. Jamie sent me two versions of these scripts and they're both really, he likes them both. And they're actually slightly different. I don't think something like that has, I can't think of like something like that being done. It's just a really interesting experiment where you have essentially two versions of the same story that were made side by side. Yeah, it's odd. You know, it's just like, yeah, just go,
I think it's like that Woody Allen movie, Melinda and Melinda. Remember that one? Where it was like the two Wally Shawn and what's his name arguing, and they say, you know, life, you know, the same story as a comedy and then one as a tragedy.
It's kind of, yeah, well, both the movies have slightly different tonalities too. They're just different in some way, which really is fascinating. again, nobody's really watched them. They come out, they disappear, they just kind of go out into the void. And I think once in a while, somebody will, especially now they're on YouTube. So now like somebody will just come across it and go, oh, this looks like something I might want to watch. And then 10 minutes into it, they're just like, what the fuck am I watching? You know?
So it goes. Yeah, no, I've been lucky enough recently to have one of mine. It did come out on DVD in the States there in the UK, but now it's on YouTube for free.
Oh, sweet. What is it? What is it?
It's called The Legend of Whores. That's H-A-W-E-S.
Whores?
Yeah.
Whores. The Legend of Whores. All right. I'm going to check that one out, Ken.
It's a Western also.
Those do pretty well. Westerns do well.
Yeah. I mean, it's a Western. It's a Western horror. It's weird. I went from particular director, I started with horror, then a Western, then a horror Western. It was truly strange. But as you were saying before, thinking of the producer, that was something that Jim Wynorski actually said to me once. Because oddly enough, I did approach him about maybe writing something for him. And oddly enough, the film, he did go on and make the Bigfoot movie, Bigfoot or Bust. Mine was a bit more traditional. He said, do you have any treatments or anything for like a Bigfoot movie? And I did have something. It wasn't specifically a Bigfoot film, but I just changed the monster. Yeah, well, it can be Bigfoot. And he says, you know, it's very well written, but, you know, you need to think like a producer. And at that time, I had no idea what he was on about because I didn't have any experience as far as that was concerned. But like you said, doing these independent movies, particularly when the directors are also the producers and closely connected to the finance and distributors, as a lot of them are, as a lot of them will say to you, you know, we don't really get to choose the films that we make. The distributors sort of, well, we need a horror, a Western, an action. You know, those three are kind of always the easy sell, depending on which way the market's going. If it starts off the year with horror, then it's going to be horror. Like you said, Western's always good. Mix them up. Yeah. Like The Legend of Oz is a horror Western. Same vein as like Bone Tomahawk kind of scenario.
Oh, cool.
But it definitely is a lesson for screenwriters out there listening. Being able to, there's a whole lot of difference, as you say, from sitting writing in some ways indulgent pieces, or even screenplays that you think could be made for a single location and a low budget. There's really no substitute for experience. And I find, probably just as you did, actually going through it and writing a script as productioners and doing production rewrites and stuff like that. Well, we can't afford to do this. This has to change, blah, 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 blah. And yeah, there's no substitute for actually going through that. There's certainly nothing that I ever learnt.
I mean, I knew all this too, because even before I started writing, I actually did like a year in television in Japan as an assistant director. So I was in the trenches on, you know, TV sets, and, you know, I saw these Japanese scripts being deconstructed and shooting very minimally. And then, you know, there was a prop room, and then you prepare the props, you build the set, you take down the set. Like, all of this was like in me. But I think the temptation when people start writing is, you know, of course you can write, you know, I think like Stephen Graham Jones once said, you know, you there's no budget to a fictional piece. You can make cars blow up, you can explode buildings and spaceships, and, you know, you can put anything on the page, which makes it really fascinating and a really rich medium. And I think, but like, you know, somebody like yourself or like myself who, you know, is drawn to the structure of a screenplay, that's a completely different experience to me. And I realized it, you know, right away, working with Jim on these movies back in 2013, which came about, and there were very strict limitations in terms of, like, you know, we have to have a certain amount of love scenes in these movies. You have to have the love scenes should occur every so often, you know, every so many pages. You got to hit a beat here. You got to hit a beat here. Don't make the script longer than, you know, X amount of pages. That's never changed. That's never change. Like that to me, like that's cinema now. You know, that's why I don't even watch, I don't really watch that many movies any. I'll watch movies, don't get me wrong, but I'm not, I wouldn't consider myself like an avid movie watcher who's, you know, out there all the time. I'll go back and like enjoy things and kind of soak up their texture, soak up their tonality, soak up their beauty, and then try to kind of adapt that. But that, that structure and that, those limits, because you're gonna always be the only person who's alone with that story. It's gonna be you, or you and your writing partner, or you and the producer who's reading it. But you know, essentially it's gonna be the person putting it down as a screenplay is gonna have that privacy of the story, the fantasy of the story in its complete richness. After you release that screenplay, no longer, it will never be exactly how you imagined it ever, you know? And I learned that really early on as well with the, and that's just like the nature of the media. And it actually used to give me a lot of anxiety because there was something about hearing the dialogue that I would write and then hearing somebody actually voicing it. That's not an affront to the actors at all. It's not an affront to the directors or the producers. It's more just like there's something that happens. There's an experience that happens when you hear your own words being spoken through the mouths of others in a very disconnected medium. And especially when you realize like, this isn't the rich thing I imagined in my imagination. It looks a lot different. It feels a lot different. And I think once you kind of embrace that, and you're able to kind of meet people who can kind of take your fantasy and kind of meet it in a way that kind of becomes true to the way you saw it as well. I think that's when you can have a really enriching cinematic experience as a screenwriter. At least that's just my truth.
No, I'm in total agreement with you because it's,
I don't know if that made sense, but
it's not, For especially, well, from my point of view, for a kid whose ambition, like once I learned what filmmaking was when I was very young, all I ever wanted to do was get my name somewhere on a movie poster and hang that movie poster in my room. And I was fortunate
to
live long enough to do that. So
good.
Yeah. So every day since then has been gravy, my friend. So it's as I agree with the master Stanley Kubrick. He said making films is a privilege, and it is indeed. And being part of being able to do that which you love for a living is equally a privilege.
Yeah, it's nobody has to produce your script. I mean, nobody has to read your script. Nobody wants to read your script. Not you, Kent, but like in general, like no, nobody's going to come knock on your door. Nobody's going to email. So I had the good fortune of having somebody who became obsessed with me, and that was completely serendipitous as well. And they pumped me to people far and wide. And I'm not even going to mention the relationships that came from that, but like real ones did. And I'm very gracious, pretty, you know, grateful for that. But that doesn't usually, like, that's not the norm. You know, the norm is that you'll write and write and get rejected, and you'll crank out something and you'll get close. Maybe you won't, but nobody's ever obligated to take your art seriously. So, I mean, I think a really good exercise is to make yourself duplicatable. You know, you have to be duplicatable to some extent. You have to write things that people, you know, want to or can produce. So you have to be taken seriously by those people. So like you taking something out to Jim Wynorski, me taking out something to Jim Wynorski many years ago, or I don't know when you did it, but
around the same time. Yeah.
That was like 10 years ago, but for me, but that's just, those are smart moves because, you know, we're always standing on somebody's shoulders. And, you know, I didn't do nothing I've ever done is just like a completely original anything. You know, I'm always bowing down to so many different people. And so I have no qualms about reaching out to those people and, you know, humbling myself toward them and, you know, trying to tell them like, well, let me try to make something for you, because at least I know I have the ability to kind of at least give them something. And if they don't want it, I've been rejected. I understand pain I understand massive amounts of pain, and I can confront it and handle it. So, you know, getting used to that darkness is something that I would teach, you know, any screenwriter beyond writing. It can be a very lonely process. It could be a very desperate process. And so you have to come at it with, you know, with such a, you have to be your own. You have to champion yourself, you know, in so many ways. And then you have to, I think, constantly be just really looking for ways that you can be, you know, who are you going to be, you know, how can this script live through somebody else's directorial vision? And if there's nobody out there that can direct it, then you need to fucking direct it, you know, by yourself. You need to figure out a way to get it made. Because nobody's going to figure out a way for it to get made if you don't. At least it needs to start from you. You need to be the source point.
That's true. Before we run out of time, Jamie Graffy, thank you for being on Cinema Yugen, mate. A font of wisdom, a wonderful discussion, worth waiting for. It's been fantastic to hear about your rise and rise. May it continue, my friend.
Wow. Kent, you know, may it continue. I don't know where it's going to go.
Yes, thank you, Jamie Graffy. Great, great work. The rise and rise. May it continue, my friend. We're going to put in the description box links to all of Jamie's socials and his website. He has lots of potentially cool stuff on the way. He's a man to watch, a talent to behold. Jamie Graffy, check him out. He's all of the links in the description box. And we thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to us again, my little Yugenites. Stay tuned right here to Cinema Yugen on Spotify or wherever you listen to us. Catch you next time.